I'd like now to welcome Adam Horowitz. He's a filmmaker and artist, and his new documentary is called Nuclear Savage. It screens tomorrow, Wednesday, the 5th of September, at 7 o'clock in the evening at the CCA. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a documentary about nuclear tests in the Marshall Islands in the 1950s and the ongoing radiation that was a result of that and that affected the islands and the people on them. It's Secret Project 4.1, which, of course, I've never heard of, nobody's ever heard of, except the very few people who've been looking into it. How did you come across this information and come to make this documentary?
I have been going to the Marshall Islands for 25 years. I first went to the Marshall Islands in 1986 and made my first film there, which was about Star Wars missile testing and the effects of ongoing missile testing in the Marshall Islands. And that film was called Home on the Range. And it was released in 1990. And I went to the Marshall Islands several times in the 1980s and again in the 90s and became quite involved in Marshall Islands life and made a lot of friends there and became very familiar with the long-term effects of American nuclear testing and still ongoing missile testing there. And so I made that first film beginning in 1986, and it came out in 1990, and then I was away from the islands for many, many years, and got a call from one of the leaders in the islands who said, you want to come back and make another film? And I got some funding to go back and make another film, and I went back 20 years later to see what had changed in 20 years. And that's how this film, Nuclear Savage, came about. It was kind of a sequel to that first film I made 20 years ago.
So what had changed in 20 years?
Well, when I was there in the 1980s, I met a lot of survivors and victims of this nuclear testing who had been exposed to radiation. And they all told me back then that they had been used as human experiments and human guinea pigs and that they were experimented on. And there was not documentary proof at that time that they had been intentionally exposed. So when I went back to make this film, I was skeptical still of the claims of intentional experimentation. But some of the island leaders had obtained some secret documents, which they put in my hands, which proved that the U.S. government had intentionally exposed people in order to study them. And it was interesting because this film, Nuclear Savage, is not the film I had intended to make. I had intended to do a sequel to that first film, which was called Home on the Range, which was more about these island leaders, and it was more of a personal story. And then when I started uncovering these secret documents and proof that people were intentionally exposed and intentionally used as human guinea pigs, I said, this is a much more important story.
So let's back up a moment. There were nuclear tests done in the 1950s, and one of the ones that you talk about a lot is the Bravo test that happened in 1954. It was a hydrogen bomb, thermonuclear bomb test, and these tests essentially obliterated islands. They would drop a bomb and destroy everything on it. And why they dropped so many bombs, it was dozens and dozens of them, maybe you can tell us that too, but it affected not only the island but the islands around it. And that is the crux of some of your documentary, is that the wind blew radiation onto a completely inhabited island.
Yes. The U.S. government, at Department of Energy, or at that time it was the Atomic Energy Commission that was responsible for these tests, did 67 atmospheric nuclear bomb tests in the Marshall Islands, and most of them were hydrogen bombs, which are much, much larger than atomic bombs. And the biggest bomb they did was this Bravo test in 1954, which was 1,000 times bigger than the Hiroshima bomb. That's something that it's hard to wrap your head around. If you think about 1,000 Hiroshimas in one explosion, it's mind-boggling. And that particular test vaporized an entire island. There was an island that became a crater. And where this island used to be is now a big hole in a coral reef with a big, deep blue sea where an island used to be. And there were inhabited islands less than 100 miles away, which is, for a bomb of that size, is nothing. And they had evacuated these people for much smaller tests previously. And it was very curious that a bunch of inhabited islands a very short distance away were not evacuated before the test, which was quite telling. And when the bomb went off, the fallout blew onto several inhabited islands and fell like snow. And it was a couple of inches deep, and it was white ash. And the islanders had not been warned in any way about this. And some of them actually thought it was snow that was falling, but it was actually radioactive fallout ash. And they became very sick and covered with burns, radiation burns, and their skin was peeling off, and their hair fell out, and they were vomiting. And they were left on this island for more than 2 days in the fallout before they were evacuated. And as soon as they were evacuated, they were all given numbers and enrolled in this secret Project 4.1, which ended up tracking them for many, many years to see the effects of radiation. And the United States government, the DOE, has long maintained that the exposure of these islanders was an accident and that the wind shifted and that their exposure was not intended. But so many things belie that fact, including their own weather reports at the time, which said that the wind was blowing directly at these inhabited islands. But the other really incriminating evidence is what came out recently are these secret documents that I have put in the film and gotten my hands on, which show that the scientists intended to expose people and study them. And this experiment, Project 4.1, was first conceived in 1953, a year before the exposure happened, a year before the Bravo test. There was a secret meeting at Los Alamos, and scientists came up with this plan to study the effects of fallout radiation, biological effects, and it's really a smoking gun. And 5 months before, and several documents over the year before the test came out, which all reiterated their plan to expose people in order to study them. And then later on, not only were people exposed from the direct fallout of the test, but they were then put on a contaminated island with the precise intent of seeing what happens to people who eat radioactive food.
Now, this was the same people?
This was the same people who had received near-fatal doses. They were from this island called Rungalap. And the Rungalap people who were in this fallout that felt like snow and were horribly burned and had their hair fall out and received near-fatal doses, they were taken off the island for 3 years, during which time they were studied and monitored. And 3 years later, in 1957, the U.S. government moved them back to Rungalap, which was heavily contaminated.
Which they must have known.
They not only knew that it was contaminated, they knew precisely how contaminated it was, because scientists from Los Alamos had been making precise measurements on the island, and they had measured the groundwater and the coconuts and the breadfruit and the pandanus and even the crabs, and knew that all of the food on the island was highly contaminated. And they came up with a plan to relocate these people back to the contaminated island. to see what happens. And there are several documents where they state categorically, let's see what happens when people live in a contaminated environment. This is a perfect opportunity. And that was actually one of the things that really drove me to make that the focus of the film, because the DOE and Los Alamos, they love to obfuscate issues and make things about safety and non-intentional issues. And, you know, if they contaminate the groundwater or they have a release here, it's always unintentional. But in this case, they purposely exposed people to study them. And for me, as a filmmaker living close to Los Alamos, that was something that I found devastating and really important to bring to light. And because I think it puts the lab and the DOE in a whole different light when we realize that they were willing to use these islanders as guinea pigs and to purposely expose them and ruin their lives for the sake of scientific experimentation. And I think for those of us who live in this area so close to the lab, it's really important that we know what they are capable of. These islanders were left for 30 years on this contaminated island, and they had birth defects and cancers, and they were studied extensively the entire time. The DOE sent a research ship every year to go make measurements. When somebody died, they do an autopsy and cut out their organs and body parts and take them away in a jar for study. They brought these islanders to a DOE laboratory in Brookhaven, Long Island.
Now, was it the DOE?
The Atomic Energy Commission became the DOE under the Carter administration. It's the same people. It's the same organization. So when I say DOE, it was previously known as the AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission. But it's the same people.
But in any case, they were studying these people and finding, and of course you interview in the film, we're talking to Adam Horowitz about the documentary Nuclear Savage. You interview people who had children who were born with no bones and babies that were born with the most horrible birth defects. One woman said, I had a baby, but it looked more like a bunch of grapes. I mean, and people who died prematurely, people whose children died, people who died of horrible cancers. And these things were all just kind of blithely studied by people who, and I couldn't help thinking the whole time, it's like you have to, on some level, dehumanize these people in order to study them in this way. I mean, it was a slight difference between studying them and studying sheep and mice and all these other animals whom they also exposed to radiation.
They dehumanized these people when they made a decision to move them back to a contaminated island. One of the documents, the head of the Atomic Energy Commission at that time, Merrill Eisenbud, said that, well, these people are not civilized like us, but they're more like us than mice. And that was a typical statement from the scientists at that time. And I think it was definitely based on racism and how they justified exposing these people and using them in this way. And even the title of the film, Nuclear Savage, refers to a government newsreel at the time where they referred to the islanders as savages.
And I have to say, that was one of the most shocking parts of the film, even though one should no longer be shocked at anything at this point in history. But the way that these people were called savages and the absolute and total arrogance and dehumanization of them in a government newsreel, you just watch it and get sick to your stomach.
Yeah, it's beyond belief, really. It was quite a process making this film as well, uncovering these documents bit by bit, and it took years to put this together because A lot of the documents and footage took me years to pry out of archives, and the hands of different investigators who have been working on this for years. And it became quite depressing the more I discovered and the more I realized what had gone on.
One thing that I'm thinking, people are listening to this conversation right now that we're having and thinking, that can't be true. The U.S. government couldn't possibly have really done that. And of course, we've done all kinds of things, and governments all over the world, when they get a certain amount of power and feel like they're immune from any kind of oversight by anybody else, do all kinds of horrible things. But it's one, and certainly not the only, film of this kind that really makes you have to re-examine this whole myth of the upstanding moral character of the United States. We've done stuff to people that's just as awful as anything, anywhere, anybody has ever done.
Yeah, that's one of the things that kept me going and made it important for me to tell this story, is it's beyond excuse. And these islanders, were not even Americans, and yet they were sacrificed in the name of some harebrained medical experiments justified for U.S. security during the Cold War. And I actually, there's a reference made to the Nuremberg trials of Nazi doctors after World War II. And the charges against the Nazi doctors who experimented on people sounded very similar to what was done to the Marshall Islanders. It's a human rights abuse, really. And that's... It's a sign of the times that we're not even that shocked by this kind of thing, where we say, I'm not that surprised. But after Abu Ghraib and all the torture of so-called terrorists and people being imprisoned and tortured for years without charges. Even those terrorists were suspected of waging war of some kind on the United States, but these Pacific Islanders were never a threat of any kind to anyone. So the fact that the U.S. government went out to the middle of paradise and picked these islanders to experiment on is the worst. I think. Because we live so close to the lab, it's good for us to know what they are capable of.
Now, not only were all of these bombs dropped, and many, many bombs were dropped, and one wonders why they had to explode 67 bombs?
67 bombs.
In such a short period of time. I couldn't help thinking there's just some joy that certain kinds of people take in watching things explode. I mean, above and beyond any rational considerations of national security or science or anything else. But beyond that, the people who did survive, you talk about this, and Americans themselves talked about this part of the world as a place of island paradises where people were very good sailors and navigators, and they lived off the land, and they had a thriving culture and a very sustainable culture. And they were moved onto neighboring islands where they were packed very, very densely into small areas, and they became basically slum dwellers with all the disease and poverty and loss of culture that comes with that.
Yeah, the nation and the culture of the Marshall Islands was effectively beaten to a pulp by the military colonization. And the military created ghettos for the islanders where they remain today. This one ghetto at the U.S. missile base has over 16,000 people crowded onto 65 acres of land now. And it looks like the slums of Calcutta. This was a paradise where people were completely self-sufficient, and now they live in an overcrowded slum with missile testing going on. where the missile testing is going on is a place called Kwajalein, which was the base for the nuclear tests of the 50s. Today is known as the Ronald Reagan Ballistic Missile Test Site, and that's where these thousands of islanders are crowded into this little ghetto watching Star Wars missile testing overhead.
Now, PBS was involved in the making of this film. Is that correct?
Yes. PBS actually supplied major funding for this film. I think that they got more than they bargained for, because it's already been a subject of tug of war and content arguments between me and executives at PBS, who I think did not know what they were getting into when they funded this film. It's going to be interesting to see how they handle it in the end.
But it will be shown.
Well, I cannot say that for sure, because I've been in discussions with, not directly with the executives, but with go-betweens between me and executives who will not talk to me directly. So it's a fascinating process, realizing how PBS content is regulated. So there's regulation from these top executives in New York and Washington, and then there's the individual PBS stations around the country who also can decide whether or not they want to show it.
Well, if it is shown, we might see it, or it will certainly be seen by on some PBS stations around the country.
Yes, it will be seen on some PBS stations, and I certainly hope that KNME in Albuquerque will show it, because it is so relevant to this area. But it may require some attention on the public's part to see that it's shown here. And I think even with attention, it may not be shown here. So that remains to be seen.
We will keep our listeners up to date on that. I want to encourage everybody to go see this film. It's tomorrow night at the CCA at 7 o'clock. It's called Nuclear Savage. And there's many moments of light and beauty and hope in it. It's not just depressing, although it certainly has the depressing aspects that we've been talking about. It's also a beautifully made and edited film by filmmaker and artist Adam Horowitz. I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, and come to the show, 7 o'clock.
Excellent. And I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Arwen Donahue. She is an artist. She's the author of the, what should we call it, a comic book?
I've been calling it a comic book.
Okay.
Yes.
It's called Old Man Gloom. It's about Zozobro. Well, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. So
it's an interesting genre, because it's not like a comic book that makes you laugh or that has superheroes in it exactly. It's more this genre of kind of almost like visual memoir and reflection.
Yes. And it would clearly be a graphic novel if it were long enough. But
exactly.
It's 16 pages long, so formally it's a comic book, even though it's not funny. And I've heard it described that you can call, you know, novels back in the day were just called novels because they were new. They were a new form. And it doesn't really describe what a novel is anymore, but that's what we use. So that makes sense to me.
It's about, so Old Man Gloom, and of course Fiesta is coming up, which is why we're doing this right now and which is why you're here, but is about Zozobra. Now, you grew up or spent a lot of your childhood here and have memories of this Zozobra phenomenon.
Yes. It was a very intense part of my childhood, was seeing Zozobra burn, and that gave rise to this book. And I didn't think just that the intensity of my own personal memory made a good story, but I thought that the way that that story kind of meshes with the history of Santa Fe and the way that the community remembers our history made for an interesting story.
Did you actually feel haunted by this creature when you were young?
Definitely, I felt haunted. I had such ambivalent feelings about Zozobra, because I was terrified the first time that I saw Zozobra burn. I was afraid that that he was going to swallow my father whole, even though we were very far away. I was very young. And then I felt afterwards that he, that Zozobra was pursuing me, and when I would hear him at night, and my brother would say, "Oh, that's a motorcycle. It's not Zozobra," but I felt that it was. I heard Zozobra's voice in motorcycles and cars and things at night, so it was very. And then I saw, when I'd see bits of paper in the trees, I thought it was Zozobra had scratched himself there and left. And that wound up in the book, too.
Right. Now, of course, the book starts out with a bit of kind of New Mexico history, starting with the history of Fiesta and Don Diego de Vargas. How does that, for you, tie into the Zozobra story?
Well, I chose to bring that in because as a child, I went to Adelaide Elementary School, and I have also clear memories of the de Vargas figure and his court coming to my school and being taught something about the Pueblo Revolt and about, well, not really being taught about the Pueblo Revolt, actually, but being taught about de Vargas's peaceful reconquest.
Right.
And then... and really so-called peaceful reconquest.
Yeah, sort of one-sided history.
It didn't wind up being that.
Right.
And then I remembered de Vargas telling us, telling the children in the class, that we should go see Zozobra burn and that we needed to burn our glooms away. And I thought that... So I always associated de Vargas and Zozobra with the same historical moment, even though I didn't understand... as a child what that meant, but as I grew older and started reading more about the Pueblo Revolt and reading about Santa Fe history, I thought that was an interesting confluence of things that aren't really related.
Well, it does make one think about when you have a history that is violent, that your town or your place or your ancestors partook in, and we can talk for days about the Pueblo Revolt and the history of this area, but when you have that, it's part of the kind of underlying story of a place, and it's, you know, part of that story is our dark side, right? And so when you talk about Zozobra, you're talking about burning away our own dark side. And I often wonder, we as Americans, it seems like we're always trying to do that. We're just trying to burn our dark side away and ignore it or just make it vanish.
Right. Yes. And so I felt as a child, being sort of a melancholic person, I felt like Zozobra was kind of with me because I had not succeeded in burning my gloom away. I had not done what we were told we had to do.
Right.
And I thought that had resonance for me personally, but I think it there's a communal resonance too, because I think that I've talked to other people who felt the same way.
Right. Well, there's a character in this quote-unquote comic book, which is a little red figure with a fiery hat and a tail. Is it like a devil person?
It's actually the figure that is sometimes called the fire. It's a ribbon.
It's a ribbon, yeah. Or it looks like it could almost be a whip.
Yeah. It's actually meant to be the fire spirit or the fire dancer who ignites Zozobra at the beginning of the burning. So she... In this book, it's a woman, and it's fictionalized. So she, it's as if she's narrating her childhood, and she's a child who was haunted by Zozobra, and then later in life becomes the fire spirit who sets Zozobra on fire. So in reality, it's I think there have just been three or so fire dancers since the beginning of the tradition. But the idea behind this in the comic book, behind the fire spirit telling the story, is that at the end there's sort of, as if it seems to be this happy ending. She seems to have overcome Zozobra by becoming the person who sets him on fire. But then she says, "We don't really set him on fire. He continues to live inside of all of us and in ways that our fires can't touch," and refers to the ways that we the things that we don't remember communally as the reason why Zozobra keeps coming back again and again, the gloom keeps coming back again and again, because we can't just tuck away that history and pretend that it doesn't exist.
Right. And meanwhile, we've made a whole new year's worth of glooms.
Yeah.
Since the last time it burned.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is this one of the main things you do, is you're an artist making these kinds of books?
Well, this is actually my first comic book, and it came out of a long writing project that had a section in it about Zozobra and this tradition, and that novel never came to fruition, and I worked on it for years and didn't feel like it was ever going to be finished after those years.
Right.
And so I put it aside and started getting back to my first love, which was drawing, and illustrated some books, worked on various visual art projects, and then eventually I just found myself drawing pictures from the novel that I had put aside. And I drew a lot I took a pot of India ink and a brush and started drawing these sketches of Zozobra interacting with a child. And then I put those away, and months later looked at them and thought, wait a minute, these could really, the words and the pictures could really do something interesting together. So I set about focusing on that. But in my life as a whole, I live in central Kentucky, and I am co-owner with my family of a small organic vegetable farm, and we raise vegetables for local market there, and so that keeps me pretty busy. And I have a child, and I also do freelance research and writing, and so this is kind of different than what I've done before.
right. Well, it's a wonderful book. It's called Old Man Gloom, and Arwin Donahue will be tomorrow night at St. John's College, Wednesday, September 5th, in the Junior Common Room at 6:30, presenting the book and signing it for people. And she will also be at Page One Bookstore in Albuquerque on Friday, the 7th of September at 7 in the evening, and at Astro Zombies in Albuquerque, signing books on Saturday from 1 to 4. The book is available at Garcia Street Books and at the website arwindonahue.com. And Arwin is spelled A-R-W-E-N, arwindonahue.com. I'll link to it on my website as well, santaferadiocafe.org. Arwin, thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Rulan Tangen. She's a choreographer, dancer. She's the artistic director of Dancing Earth. And that is an indigenous contemporary dance ensemble. And they're doing a new production, which is premiering at the Lensic here in Santa Fe on September 28th and 29th. It's called Walking at the Edge of Water. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be back.
So you're doing this and all kinds of things focusing on water, which I think is a terrific thing to do here in the middle of the desert.
You know, it's actually been a theme that's been, we've been called to by mostly Native grandmothers, but also some other elders, but not just in desert areas. There's actually huge things going on with water in all parts, even in the eastern woodlands up in Ontario, Canada. This was actually inspired by some grandmothers who started to walk at the edge of the Great Lakes, the entire circumference of the Great Lakes, in order to call attention to the need to respect the waters and remember their sacred origins.
Indigenous grandmothers walked the entire circumference of the Great Lakes.
Yes, they did it over an 8-year period, concentrating in the springtime, because that's when the weather was. And while they were doing that, they were carrying water in copper buckets. So it's a huge feat of strength. And I was told this story by an Anishinaabe woman at a performance that we did up in Indiana. She said, "You know, the next piece you need to do needs to be about this story." And then the next thing I knew, I was in Canada at an Indigenous Women's Symposium, and I was sitting next to Josephine Mandouin. She is the grandmother who started it, and she said she had been at a water conference, and she was hearing all these things, and she felt like, oh, what can I do? I'm just a little grandmother. And then the speaker looked at her and said, what are you going to do about it? And she said to herself, well, I can walk. And so that's what she did. And as she told that story, she looked at me when she said, and what are you going to do about it? And by that time, I think it had already been a couple years with several different grandmothers of many different nations posing that same question to me. So at a certain point, it's like drops in a bucket. It fills up, and you're like, okay, it's time to make this choreography.
It's interesting to me that you, in your work, and I think it reflects a larger thing that's going on, so many different indigenous people are coming together around the same themes, and they're basically themes of connection to the earth and respect for the earth and respect for each other.
Yes, I think, this is a prophecy year for many nations, including the Mayan nation, and it seems that one of the great teachings is when indigenous people can sort of come from the desert to the people of the mountains, to the people of the waters, and discuss the, what are the common threads. And it often has to do with, care of the earth. But in order to get there, you sort of acknowledge the diversity of the circle. So, it's a huge circle with many points on it, and everyone's got their responsibility for their perspective that they can see only from their side. So the rainforest people might be saying this, might be saying that. So we use the diversity as a way to find out about what are the things that are important to address, because there are many, many issues that are going on for all people and for all living creatures. So it's a way to sort of get together and, like I said, through diversity, acknowledge the most crucial issues of our time and move our songs and dances and artwork to express those realities.
And so then how do you take all of those big ideas and big world problems and experiences and then craft them into the kind of dances that you do having to do with water? The performance is called Walking at the Edge of Water.
Yeah, it was like carrying this gigantic heavy bowl of water and all of these concerns about water. And part of it is believing that, in fact, dance is part of, it's always been part of our functional ritual in order to express what's going on. And so part of it is a belief that we have the power to change things. In other words, that the dance is not entertainment. It always has a sort of healing by nature. But in terms of how do we translate, if we were going to translate an article that had facts and statistics, words are the best way to do that. So in some of the dances, you're going to see spoken word poetry and even like a rapping that'll be going on. But there's a deep ancestral memory that we invoke through our dance forms. So you can even let go of all of those things, and you'll find them by going back into the body. The body contains these memories. We are also 70% water, and we are also connected to all the different living beings on the planet, so we can try to access those in our movement from this sort of gut, visceral instinct.
So how many people do you have? And as you say, you incorporate other forms like spoken word and rap and percussion and all kinds of things. Give us like a sense of what it feels like and looks like.
This is amazing. We have, I think it's going to be 22 artists that are all gathered coming from as far away as Canada and New Zealand.
And all indigenous people.
All indigenous people. Some of the international guest artists have gotten special fellowships in order to come and join us because of the importance of the theme and the excitement of working with indigenous people with such diversity like Dancing Earth always has. And what's been interesting to me is seeing how, I was saying to you that dance is always a collaborative process because it's always music, costumes, and movement. But in this case, we're seeing that the dancers, the people that we're calling dancers, I'm just going to call them artists from now on because they're basically very expressive people who are coming in and like we were painting on the costumes. That's why my hands are all covered with paint.
Right.
And they are also musicians. They're also poets. So they're interdisciplinary, each of themselves. So when you walk into rehearsal, it's just this beautiful collage. You hear people sort of working on their poetry on one side and practicing their movements, and then some others on the side just like doing some martial arts and some breakdance, just sort of athletics, just keeping in shape about that, and other people singing. So it's I think, indicative of this indigenous way of seeing the world where all things are connected instead of separating them.
Which is so interesting, because I think that's the direction that science and Western thinking is going to, because there's a sense of, I was just reading a book about, it's called The Spine of the Continent, which is actually a Native American term for the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah.
And it's basically about how all wildlife is connected, and when you save the wolves, you're also saving the rivers and things like that. And that's something that I think is coming to be understood everywhere, even if it hasn't seeped into the general popular imagination yet.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of things that have been attributed to, like, beautiful Native mythology, and coming from the perspective that mythology is out of the imagination, and that the imagination is not reality. So we take that same premise that mythology lives in memory and imagination because it is real. And in fact, a lot of science is now catching up with some of the truths that are held in these Native stories. They're told in story form so that we can remember them. And then there's different, they're sort of subtle. You might not quite get them at first, but then 2 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later, you're like, oh, that's what it was about. Like, I often talk about this idea of coming from the sky. And it's not true for all nations. Not everyone has that creation story, but I've heard that in several nations. And then it turns out that DNA now has proven that indeed all of carbon, all of life on Earth is made from carbon, and carbon comes from the heart of dying stars falling to Earth. And I think science has also said that all of the water on Earth has come from this giant, I can't even remember, like, let's call it a meteor, and it was containing water. So it was this gift from the skies that was brought to Earth millions and millions of years ago. And all of life comes from that. So thus we are all connected through water in this way. And it's a saying that you'll hear amongst Native people, we are all connected, all my relations.
Right.
And so these are more than just sayings. These are actual science and history that are, you know, embedded into worldview and people are catching up with.
And wisdom.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, we're talking to Rulan Tangen about Walking at the Edge of Water, which is a performance that's going to take place on September 28th and 29th. And it's also the kickoff of IAIA, Institute of American Indian Arts, 50th anniversary. And I'm so glad that you're going to be finally at the Lensic. Is this the first time you've performed there?
It's not the first time I've performed there, but it's the first time that the company has been invited to put on a full performance. So I think they opened maybe 12 years ago, and I performed on the stage. They were doing a sort of mosaic of all the different dance forms that represented New Mexico. So I was on stage then, and then later with the Santa Fe Dance Festival. But this marks a sort of historic moment for us in our hometown to be invited onto the most prestigious, biggest stage in Santa Fe, and to be invited the same way guest companies are invited to come in, like Aspen, or, you know, I think... You know, just a lot of the amazing companies that have been in town, Bill T. Jones, Aspen Santa Fe Ballet, and indeed we're presented in that manner when we go to Arizona, Colorado, Canada, we go all different places, but finally we're home at this amazing theater with amazing, I mean, Bob Martin's been a great mentor, kind of, you know, saying, hey, you're not ready yet, but here's what you need to do.
Yeah.
And then when he said, okay, we're ready, I almost wept. You know, I worked so hard for this. And IIA is also instrumental, because it just, talk about perfect timing, I call it divine choreography. They're getting ready for their 50th anniversary, and performing arts was a legacy, it's part of their legacy. There's not any at the institution right now, but we're actually mentoring a number of IAIA students, bringing them in on all different levels of production. And then I also have to mention Santa Fe Art Institute, because they're hosting all of these dancers in their dorms. And
my goodness.
Yeah, we've turned it into, like, that's where we've been painting, and, you know, they're cooking and they're dancing in the halls. And we couldn't do it without them, because, we were thinking of everything, like, can we put them in tents? Can they all sleep in one hotel room? And we did that this summer. Believe me, it was a circus. So
that's crazy.
It's actually a little bit more professional to have them each, at least two in a room now instead of five.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, you're going to be doing some events also at the Santa Fe Art Institute. There's a workshop which is open to community members to explore local water issues through movement. So you're going to be basically what, helping people improvise in dance movements?
Yeah, I always open my workshops to people who are non-dancers, because there's even people in my company who didn't realize they were dancers until very recently. I think there's this innate movement that, you know, if you can walk, if you're lucky enough to be able to walk, there's some movement in you, and people feel very empowered when they can sort of just be in their body. I think that's why yoga is so popular right now. So it's inviting people to access that kind of expression through their bodies, and we'll also be using some drawing and some writing techniques, and then someone might be like, you know what, I want to just keep working on my drawing for the rest of this session. You know, I'm open to that too.
And that's Saturday and Sunday, yeah. The 8th and 9th of September from 4 to 7, and people can go to sfai.org or call Santa Fe Art Institute for more information on that. And you're also going to be giving a lecture, and there will be a reception the following Monday, the 10th of September, at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall, where the Santa Fe Art Institute always has their lectures. So you'll be, what, giving us a preview? Or
I think what I'm going to do is talk about the creative process that is going to go into the work in the Lenzic, because like, it's been about 6 years of cultural research and all kinds of, you know, interesting stories that have tumbled through. And it's my chance to put those stories through words as opposed to through dance, and so people can get more sense of the background of what goes into making a work like this.
You said before, I often think about the fact that dance is so much a part of culture, but it becomes so much more real when you're doing it yourself, and it changes you more when you're doing it yourself than when you're sitting in a chair and watching it.
Yeah, I actually think that's one of the things I try to do with the dancing is, that's on stage is, like, we use breath a lot because there's an exchange of energy that happens, so amplifying that energy exchange. And sometimes when I leave really spectacular dance, I feel like, oh gosh, look what they can do. Like, it's about them and me. And I want people to look on stage and see these amazing movements, but feel like they could do them. So there's a sense of what's organic and natural to invite that into people, to invite us to be more alive in our bodies.
Did you look at a lot of water? Did you look at waterfalls and lakes and rivers and things like that when you were thinking about the choreography?
Yes, I did some of that. I was up in Nambe Falls this summer with my cousin, and we were putting our feet into the water and noticing how our weight would shift as the water would push against us. Also up in Canada, I was up in British Columbia by the ocean, and in Ontario by the Otonabe River, which means the heart that beats, or the river that runs like a beating heart. So I did some of that exploration out in nature, and then when the dancers came, we did a lot of our studio work outside the studio. We did it, our rehearsals, outdoors, so we could start to bring in that sense of wind in the trees and the different sounds that come in. So definitely trying to experience nature through our bodies and share that with the audience. But I also looked at a lot of artwork. There's been, you were talking about how important it is in the Southwest. So many of our symbols that come from the idea of water. I mean, across many cultures, there's things that different symbols, because of it being the source of life. So, like those symbols, sometimes we're interpreting those symbols and those patterns with our body, and it creates a very interesting choreographic formation, for example.
Very interesting. Rulan Tangen is choreographer, dancer, and artistic director of Dancing Earth and Dancing Earth Indigenous Contemporary Dance Creations. Can be found on the web at dancingearth.org. They will be at the Lenzic on the 28th and 29th of September, and at the Santa Fe Art Institute doing the various things that we talked about before that, sfai.org. And, of course, for tickets, it's always 988-1234. Rulan, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.